Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
Well, I, of course, am not, of course, who would know except me? I'm not on the North American continent this weekend. I'm in London. But I do have a couple of consoling words for Herman Cain this weekend. One is, wait about 15, 20 years. Apparently, old adulteries are less disturbing to Republicans than new adulteries, as Newt Gingrich is in the process of proving. And so, by then, you'll be good again. And also, I know it feels bad to be opening a campaign headquarters on the very day that, at the very moment that you announce that you're suspending the campaign. But just think of the possibilities of a Christmas pop-up pizza store. Hasn't been done until now, I don't think. So, sir, you are so welcome. It's just my way of giving back just a little bit of what you've given us over this little while. Ladies and gentlemen, news of attack. You know that the United States and Pakistan are embroiled. They don't know what the word broiled means over here, by the way. I said at a fishmonger's, would this fish be good broiled? You mean grilled? So the United States and Pakistan are engrilled in a controversy over that incident about a week ago in which American fighters, planes, I believe, among other implements of war, killed 24 Pakistani soldiers. But this weekend's Sunday Telegraph newspaper in London says there's this much clarity available. A senior Pakistan military official told the Sunday Telegraph that a border coordination unit established to avoid exactly this kind of tragedy in which the Americans and Pakistanis are arguing about who fired first that set off the American supposed retaliation. The border coordination unit, according to the Sunday Telegraph, was given incorrect details of a suspected Taliban position. The strike had begun before he realized the target was a border post, said the Pakistani senior military officer. The Americans say we gave them clearance, but they gave us the wrong information. Unquote. The Telegraph adds it's understood that American officers have not disputed the Pakistani account of what went wrong. Situation normal. It's wartime. Hello, welcome to the show.
Jump.
from West London, England, where there's going to be snow on the ground, and they're going to pretend that it never happens this time of year, except last year and the year before that. I'm Harry Shearer. Welcome you to this edition of Le Show. And now, we're not number one. Dateline Paris, New Zealand is at the top of the list of the world's cleanest governments, followed by Finland and Denmark. Somalia and North Korea tied for most corrupt, according to a report this week from Transparency International. The nonprofit organization based in Berlin says it's seeking to highlight the role corruption plays in social discontent, noting that the wave of global protests shows citizens believe governments and public institutions lack accountability. You think? Really? Rounding out the cleanest governments, a sweep for Scandinavia, it would seem, Sweden, Norway, then Singapore, the Netherlands, Australia, Switzerland, and Canada. Australia and Canada, they're so like us, and yet the United States ranked 24th. Behind Qatar and Chile, which tied for 22nd place, one step ahead of France. We beat France. That's all that really counts, isn't it? Come on. And Britain is way ahead of us at number 16 with Barbados and Austria. Germany and Japan ranked 14th. China came in at number 75. Greece, 80th, tying Colombia, El Salvador, Peru, Morocco, and Thailand. At the bottom of the list, Myanmar and, hello, Afghanistan, tied for 180th place. That's after 10 years of our nation building, ladies and gentlemen, just above Somalia and North Korea. Iraq, speaking of nation building, and Haiti, tied for 175th place. We've done good. But whatever, we are not number one. And now, news from outside the bubble. First, from the Express newspaper of India, the Indian Council of Medical Research has posted an advertisement inviting research proposals on long-term effects of methyl isocyanate gas on the residents of Bhopal. It's 27 years after the Bhopal gas tragedy caused by methyl isocyanate that left hundreds, if not thousands, dead. Data shows that the gas patients have been routinely used for clinical trials for new drugs at the Bhopal Memorial Hospital and Research Center, the 350-bed facility specifically set up on the orders of this Indian Supreme Court to provide free medical services to the gas patients. A report by the Health Ministry's Central Drugs Standard Control Organization that inspected the trial said gas patients comprised a bulk of those tested. The MIC-exposed people are not fit for clinical trials because they have known and unknown disorders not even documented in medical science, said Dr. G.M. Gulhadi, editor of the journal Monthly Index of Medical Specialties, who questioned the validity of these tests. Nobody knows, he says, what kind of pathological reactions or physiological changes are happening in their bodies. This is apart from the ethical dilemmas of whether patients dependent upon just one hospital for free treatment should be subjected to trials at all. Ethics Schmethics. From The Guardian, a British soldier has been dismissed from the army after stabbing a 10-year-old Afghan boy in his kidneys with a bayonet for no reason. Well, if it was like the American who killed an Afghan civilian, it was for sport. But no, this was for no reason. That makes no sense. Grenadier Guardsman Daniel Crook was suffering from a hangover after a heavy vodka drinking session when he bayoneted the boy who was running an errand. He could not explain why he carried out the attack. The boy's father said the attack had left his impoverished family bitter and financially burdened. More than 18 months later, the son is still unable to go to school. He said British forces were in Afghanistan to build the country and remove insurgents, not to stab a child. Hearts and minds, babe. The father has been offered $800. He asked for $40,000. I know negotiating teams like that. And this from The Telegraph. newspaper in London. Stores that are seen to be reveling too much in the festive season risk damaging sales figures by driving away stressed out customers. This according to experts. Just a reminder, Abby Hoffman once described an expert as a talkative guy from out of town. Anyway, a study has discovered that overly jolly staff, bright decorations, and Yuletide hits like Slade's Merry Christmas Everybody are a turnoff for shoppers. With stress levels running high amid the pressures of getting everything prepared for Christmas, cheerfully run stores make people less inclined to spend money. This research from the University of Oxford. That's what they're doing at Oxford. That's what those Rhodes Scholars are doing. Faced with exuberant sales assistants or shops holding Christmas celebrations, many customers may even flee empty-handed, the report warns. Nancy Puccinelli, associate fellow at the university's Said Business School, who led the research, said, quote, in the final days before Christmas, many a shopper will be feeling the pressure of the holiday season with gifts to buy and preparations to make, leading to undue stress. The extreme contrast between consumers' negative feelings and the atmosphere in the store, be it festive decorations, Christmas music, or overly enthusiastic staff, actually makes them feel worse and less willing to purchase. Oh, no. The impact on retailers who invest heavily in the run-up to the holiday season to lure customers into stores can be twofold. They may see less traffic through the store, resulting in fewer sales, and in the longer term, consumers, perhaps having found the atmosphere aversive, do not return. She added that although shoppers who are compelled to remain in cheerful stores may end up in a better mood eventually, the experience can make them value the store's goods less. Puccinelli is an expert in the psychology of marketing, believes her research on how consumer mood affects behavior could help stores boost sales in the run-up to Christmas. The report identifies music as one of the key areas for delicacy, warning that cheesy Christmas hits will no longer cut it with today's cynical shoppers. Consider classical melodies like Tchaikovsky's Nutcracker that celebrate the holiday without hitting consumers over the head with the joy they should be experiencing, the report advises. In terms of decor, it warns against bright reds and golds in favor of muted blues, silver, and white, which are shown to be more relaxing for the customers. Customers also are averse to laughing Santas. And slogans such as, "Tis the season to be merry," the report suggests. This is the war on Christmas. Fox is right. The report concludes that the staff should be encouraged, quote, to be sensitive to the holiday stress of customers, and shops should aim to create, quote, moderately positive retail environments. That strategy works by encouraging shoppers to work on improving their moods themselves and by products that will cheer them up. So the report claims. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Don't send your kid to Oxford. That's what we've learned today. But now news of the godly, ladies and gentlemen. The Right Reverend, because, of course, left reverends, we frown on those. The Right Reverend Lawrence Soper is wanted over allegations of assaulting youngsters while he was abbot of Ealing Abbey in West London. Why, that's... Right? The 69-year-old ex-banker disappeared from his current post in Rome in March when he was expected back in Britain to answer bail. It's thought he hid in monasteries on the Adriatic coast, nice, before secretly returning to Rome by train to empty his bank account in the summer. Well, ex-banker, what do you want? He's going to ignore that? He may now be hiding in the Balkan state of Montenegro, where he has friends, according to a church source. Soper taught at Ealing Abbey from 1972 to 1984, when he was made abbot, and left in 2000 when he failed to make Costello. No, just kidding. He was arrested last September, but had been allowed to return to Rome to work. Of course he would be, because he was only arrested. The abbey is at the center of an inquiry after a former monk was jailed in 2009 for a string of child sex assaults at a neighboring Roman Catholic school. There's also an internal Vatican investigation. That should be good. Father Elias Lorenzo, a prior at St. Anselmo in Rome, the monastery where Soper had been working as treasurer, said this week, he is not hiding here or in the Vatican. That would be too Dan Brown. I don't know if he's being literal or just trying to avoid swearing. News of the godly, ladies and gentlemen. But now, Yeah, it's been a while. More than 6 years after FEMA provided displaced Hurricane Katrina victims with trailers that were later revealed to be toxic, early tests suggest that dangerously high levels of formaldehyde linger in the more than 130,000 FEMA trailers still in use. This is from the New Orleans newspaper, The Lens. An air quality test done last month in a FEMA trailer housing Hurricane Katrina victims in Mississippi. They're still living in trailers in Mississippi. I thought the recovery was going so well there. Showed levels of the carcinogen that exceeded levels deemed safe by the federal government. The test was done by University of Oxford researcher Nick Shapiro, different Oxford, indicating a level of exposure of 106 parts per billion within the trailer. It was sold by FEMA in 2008 to a retired Mississippi couple who had lost their home to the hurricane and could not afford to rebuild. Like thousands of trailer residents who've come forward over the past 6 years, Charles and Barbara Seary say the formaldehyde-laced trailers have made them ill. "We have symptoms of exposure," Charles Seary said. "Headaches. My wife Barbara has a raspy, raspy voice most of the time. We have muscle aches. 2 years ago, Barbara had perfect teeth. Now she can pretty much break them off with her fingers." Though FEMA does not have an official limit for safe exposure to formaldehyde, the level registered in the Seary's trailer is high by all measures, far in excess of the 16 parts per billion declared acceptable under FEMA standards established in 2008 in response to post-Katrina lawsuits. The average formaldehyde level in manufactured homes ranges from 15 parts per billion to 36, according to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, which, along with the Department of Health, believes formaldehyde causes cancer in instances of chronic exposure. Studies have shown that chronic exposure of the same 100 parts per billion level seen in the Mississippi trailer can cause health effects in sensitive individuals, according to the CDC. Likewise, the World Health Organization has set its guideline for formaldehyde in non-occupational settings at 100 parts per billion for 30 minutes. "I wish we could leave, but we live on Social Security and a fixed income," Siri said. "We can't afford to go anywhere else." In Mississippi, as well as Louisiana, a sluggish economy has kept Katrina victims like the series from rebuilding homes and moving out of the cramped, contaminated quarters once thought temporary. Litigation continues to wind through the courts regarding the trailers, but now there have been policy changes forbidding the sale or use of the trailers as permanent housing. Thousands of the trailers went into storage. FEMA encouraged people to give up those still in the market, even creating a program so that people could sell units back to the federal governments. Officials vowed never again to use the contaminated model. But unfortunately, the saga of the toxic trailers wasn't over. The trailers had been built at a cost of $1.7 billion, plus $75 million a year to store and maintain. To partially recoup the investment, the U.S. General Services Administration sold more than 130,000 trailers on the open market with a red-lettered bumper sticker warning that they could not be used as permanent housing. "We thought we were getting a deal," Siri said. "It turns out we're just stuck." F, ladies and gentlemen, is for FEMA. And in case you missed the announcement by Herman Cain yesterday in front of his newly opened headquarters in Atlanta, which looked to all the world like to my eye, seeing it on television, like a furniture store in a mall. So, you know, close down the campaign, start the 12-hour sofa sale, I say. But anyway, in case you, and by the way, he was a bit late for his own announcement, which would suggest that the he could not run successfully against Barack Obama as more punctual. But in case you missed his approximately 25-minute oration, in which Herman Cain announced he was suspending his campaign, here would be what I nominate as almost literally the high point.
"Here's what we can do. We can move the shining city on a hill back to the top of the hilltop where it belongs."
Somehow that city slid down that hill.
"My burglars took it long before I can mail it to you still. You are the only one that I can't let it slip away. So if I'm mad with the ticker tape, try the ticket, this is what I'm gonna say. Blame it on Kane.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, news of Nice Corp. Yeah, it's nice. News of the News Corporation, nice people doing nice things. A British member of parliament with access to classified intelligence information may have had his computer hacked by tabloid newspaper reporters, possibly those including the News Corporation. Detectives have arrested a 52-year-old man on computer crime charges as the investigation into phone hacking widens to data illegally obtained from computers. Peter Hayne, the former Northern Ireland secretary, said he had met with police officers regarding an investigation into the alleged hacking of his official and personal computers when he was in office. More specifically, Scotland Yard's phone hacking squad is now working its way through 300 million, can that be, emails? From News International, detectives have arrested a series of high-profile figures, including the former News International chief executive Rebecca Brooks and ex-Downing Street communications chief Andy Coulson. The police commissioner says that police have already spent up to almost $4 million on salaries, with officials speaking to 1,800 of 6,000 potential victims. A total of 120 officers and staff are now working on the investigation, after 1,800 people came forward to express fears they may have been hacked. Mark Lewis, the lawyer who represented a number of phone hacking victims in legal cases against Nice Corp, has told the Leveson Inquiry, it's an inquiry into press ethics going on here in London, he told them of his horror at finding his family had been put under surveillance by the newspaper publisher, News Corp. Nice Corp. The father of four described how earlier this month he was shown a video by police commissioned by Nice Corp that included covertly shot footage of his 14-year-old daughter. That was truly horrific, he said. That shouldn't happen to anybody's child. I do my job, but I don't expect my children to be followed, unquote. Really? You don't? The lawyer said the surveillance had taken place in April or May of 2010. The inquiry heard it was used by former News of the World legal manager Tom Crone and Julian Pike, a partner at the respected, I should say formerly respected, legal firm Farrer & Company, and had been carried out by private investigator Derek Webb. You remember him from the short-lived TV series Derek Webb, P.I. Calling the action sickening, Lewis went on, that video was sat in the office of Nice Corp at Wapping in East London. They should be ashamed of themselves. They had no right. Seeing it was a horrific moment. There were more documents shown to the inquiry indicating that Nice Corp had tried to find information about Lewis's private life so it could be used to put pressure on him to drop his cases acting for hacking victims. He was shown documents which suggested the same was true of other lawyers, Charlotte Harris and Mark Thompson, who were also taking cases to court accusing Nice Corp of phone hacking. One of the documents submitted to the inquiry said, quote, the News of the World is planning to use these tensions and motivations as a way to force compromise and settlement. Lewis said, quote, they sought to destroy my life and very nearly succeeded. Well, they'll try better next time, babe. And Sir Paul McCartney is not dead, but was hacked, apparently. He's called for a privacy law after the police showed him evidence that his phone was hacked. He believes journalists from several newspapers were listening to his phone calls and messages around the time of his divorce from his second wife, Heather Mills. He said the invasion of his privacy had a lasting effect. I tend not to say too much on the phone now, he said in a strange accent. If I leave a message, it's benign. You edit yourself, he says, according to the new circumstances of the new world. I think it would be quite good to get some sort of laws. He told The Times, owned by Nice Corp, he knew his phone had been hacked because stories would emerge about personal details he had not told anyone. So I used to talk on the phone and say, if you're taking this down, get a life. It's a pity not to be able to talk freely on a private call. In August, Heather Mills accused the Daily Mirror of intercepting a voicemail message left by McCartney on her phone. That paper's former editor, Piers Morgan, hit back at her claim and suggested that Mills herself had hacked McCartney's phone. McCartney, of course, the latest in a series of high-profile victims of hacking. A spokesman for Nice Corp said, we are not able to comment on individual cases because we're too busy hacking. No, Nice Corp, ladies and gentlemen, nice people doing nice things.
A last-ditch attempt to save reality TV?
And a sitcom ripped from today's front page. Got to be Inside Extra Access tonight for the start of December 2011.
Hi, everybody. I'm Mike DeVere.
And I'm Pat Mungo, now in alcohol aversion therapy.
TV ratings don't lie. Or if they do, the people who know they lie don't tell the truth. In any case, the ratings for reality shows are down this season. And network executives, always eager to spot the next trend and love it to death, are embracing scripted comedy shows where people stop being goofy when the lights go out. But at least one reality show producer is fighting back and doubling down on what made reality more than real.
Yes, the numbers for reality are down. If you don't count competition shows, which to me are really a totally different animal. Reality is not about who's the better singer or dancer. It's about who's the strongest of a really compelling group of highly grotesque characters. My job is to find a new way of telling that really classic story.
Donnie Gronad is CEO of Out There Entertainment, which has been responsible for such reality hits as Model Kitchen, which pitted top fashion models in a high-stakes cook-off. And Fear Farm, where fat people had to grow food they were afraid of eating. But he admits the old formula may have seen better days.
Look, we've been in these houses where everybody has to live together. We've seen these alliances and conspiracies to house the most popular contestant, and we've seen the nasty boss. But you want to know what we haven't seen ever? And we searched the world, and this is not a format that's worked in Holland or Britain or anywhere. This is fresh. This is utterly original. It's a little thing called Cannibal Island.
Johnny's Fresh Concept is getting a fresh look from QEN, formerly the Quality Entertainment Network, as well as several of the major networks. And its concept is as simple as dog eat dog.
Well, it really is dog eat dog, in fact. Except that the humane people would never let you get away with doing this with dogs. Which would, you know, let's admit it, be very compelling television. But, so, we have the familiar arena of the island, the torches, the flames, the sunsets, all of the eye candy, and then we have the competition, which what you might call the brain candy. Except this time, nobody leaves the island during the competition. At the end, only one person leaves alive, which makes it so much less like some contrived reality format, and so much more like the way the species has until very recently always lived it. This is a connection to our heritage, to our past, to, in a sense, what's still in our DNA, except now it's in the show's DNA, too.
But isn't a show featuring people eating people going to run into what you might have to call taste issues? Donnie Gronad doesn't think so.
You know, I think we've grown up in this country. I give the viewing public a lot of credit. They've watched people eat maggots in prime time, and they've said, okay, I've got no problem with that. The standards people at the networks that we've been talking to, they've said as long as it's handled as you would if it were a dramatic show where you don't actually see people tearing into each other's flesh, but it's more kind of artistically done, left to the imagination. Oh, I get it. She's gone. He's toast. Then we're not going to red flag it. That doesn't mean they've green flagged it yet. They want to see if we're able to line up people you'd actually like to see in a really high stakes competition. That's the key. I think, especially in this economy, that I like our chances.
Cannibal Island could start shooting in an undisclosed tropical location as early as this spring.
We've grown familiar with failed presidential campaigns leading to TV careers. Just ask Pat Buchanan and Mike Huckabee as performers, and Al Gore as a behind-the-scenes mogul. But leaving a hard-fought primary campaign and returning as a sitcom star? Now that is something new under the sun.
Mr. Tyler Perry has had such enormous success with his shows, which have been blockbuster successes, and which have enjoyed great success. So when he called me, it seemed like something I would feel very comfortable with. A true no-brainer.
Herman Cain is stepping straight from the campaign trails to the sitcom stage, a star of the new Tyler Perry series, House of Cain. But can he do funny?
I have said throughout my campaign, America needs to get a sense of humor. Now, through House of Cain and my wonderful co-stars, whoever they cast, I get a chance to make that change happen. And Mr. Tyler Perry has promised me the very best comedy writers in Atlanta to make the show true to the Herman Cain character. Matter of fact, you'll never guess the address of his home. 999 Peachtree Street.
Cain says the show will allow him to deal comedically with some of the problems he encountered on the campaign trail.
The Herman Cain character in the show owns a chain of upscale gourmet pizzerias, so there are plenty of women who are attracted to him. And you can imagine the scrapes he gets into at home as a result. But we always know at the end of each show that his marriage is strong. Like I said, it's a comedy.
Tyler Perry's House of Cain starts shooting in Atlanta the day after Christmas.
That's a wrap for Inside Extra Access Tonight for today. We'll roar back tomorrow with the results of our latest IEAT Facebook poll.
We asked you which Kardashian should get divorced next, and the results will have you calling your lawyer.
Till then, I'm Mike DeVere.
And I'm Pat Mungo. So long from Culver City.
Forevermore, but that train don't stop.
This is Le Show, and now, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Well, let's start at the top, shall we? An independent report last week found that Bahrain's security forces used excessive force, not excessive security, torture, and summary justice to crush a popular protest movement that paralyzed the Gulf state earlier this year. King Hamad bin Isa Al Khalifa, Bahrain's monarch, issued an apology following publication of the 500-page report presented by Mahmoud Bassiouni, the Egyptian chairman of the five-man commission. He promised to, quote, turn a new page. Probably to find the acknowledgement. No, by taking up the report's recommendation of root and branch reform of the police. He said institutions would be reformed to international standards, possibly those of UC Davis. The University of Montana announced this week it will suspend indefinitely plans to build a woody biomass heating plant on campus. Didn't he used to coach at Ohio State? And publicly apologize for a top university administrator's derogatory comment about critics of the project. University of Montana President Royce Engstrom. Now, when you're born with that name, you know you're going to be university president when you grow up, don't you? Royce Engstrom. He cited financial viability, fuel supply, increased pollution, and the deteriorating discourse surrounding the $16 million heating project as reasons for scrapping plans to build the industrial-sized biomass gasification system. Ooh, sorry. In the foreseeable future. This marked the end of the university's year-long effort to reduce its carbon footprint by switching from natural gas for building heating to woody biomass. The UM proposed trucking in 16,000 tons of hog fuel from local forests to burn in a state-of-the-art biomass gasification boiler. It would have been the cleanest biomass boiler in the state, but would nonetheless have produced particulate pollution in a valley known for its wintertime air pollution problems. It was a bumpy road a couple of weeks ago. A comment made by Vice President of Finance Administration Bob Duringer turned the discourse ugly. He referred to the actions of environmental organizations appealing the university's air quality permit as low-level eco-terrorism. Duringer was not present at this week's news conference, but Engstrom said he wanted to apologize on behalf of Duringer for his language, quote, that inappropriately characterized those individuals who've been vocal in their opposition the biomass proposal. This debate has deteriorated to the point where civil and respectful dialogue, he said, has become difficult. Also, a university-related apology. Syracuse basketball coach Jim Boeheim apologized after a victory over Florida this week. "I believe I misspoke very badly in my response to the allegations that have been made," he said, regarding an allegation of sexual abuse by one of his associates. "I shouldn't have questioned what the accusers expressed or their motives," he said. "I am really sorry that I did that, and I regret any harm that I caused." It was the second game since the firing of the longtime associate head coach Bernie Fine, who's been accused by three men, including two former ball boys, of molesting them as minors. Fine has denied the allegations. Boeheim initially defended Fine vigorously, saying money might have been the main motivation of the accusers. Ball boys. Carrier IQ, a maker of software to monitor smartphone performance, has withdrawn from a legal attack against Trevor Eckhart and apologized to him after the Electronic Frontier Foundation came to the security researcher's defense. Eckhart published his research saying that some Samsung and HTC Android phones include the manufacturer's software, and Verizon Sprint use it as well. He documented details of what the Carrier IQ software logs, then leveled a charge calling the software a rootkit, a program that gets privileged access to a computing device, but that hides its presence. Carrier sent a cease and desist letter, but a week after the Electronic Frontier Foundation took on Eckhart's case, the company reversed course completely. In its apology, Carrier IQ back down. "We are withdrawing our cease and desist letter to Mr. Eckhart. We reached out to Mr. Eckhart and the Electronic Frontier Foundation to apologize. Our action was misguided. We are deeply sorry for any concern or trouble that our letter may have caused Mr. Eckhart. We sincerely appreciate and respect EFF's work on its behalf and share their commitment to protecting free speech in a rapidly changing technological world." Goodbye now. Facebook, speaking of technologically inept apologies, or apologies of the technologically inept, Facebook has apologized for allowing a situation that led to Merck & Company taking over the Facebook page of similarly named rival Merck KGSA. The issue has not been resolved, Reuters reports. There'll be more Facebook news coming up. One video advertisement shows a Jewish elderly couple distraught that their Israeli granddaughter in the United States thinks Hanukkah is Christmas. A series of Israeli government-sponsored ads intended to cajole Israelis living in the United States to come home smacked to many American Jews of arrogance, ignorance, and cultural disrespect of America. Israeli officials defended the desire to encourage Israeli expatriates to return, but the reaction of American Jews, a crucial mainstay of support for Israel, clearly caused alarm. A spokesman for the Israeli Ministry for Immigrant Absorption said no insult had been intended. The ministry respects and cherishes the American Jewish community, and, quote, "we wish to apologize to those who might have been offended." The Defense Ministry of Israel has apologized to the New York Times following a complaint by a pregnant photographer from the paper alleging that soldiers at the Erez crossing compelled her to pass through an X-ray machine three times, despite her protests that this endangered her pregnancy. The Defense Ministry says it's also launched a comprehensive investigation into the incident. Lucky she wasn't trying to get through LAX. The host of the British television show Top Gear, Jeremy Clarkson, apologized for saying Britain's striking public sector workers should be, quote, "shot in front of their families," unquote. Clarkson, whose mocking personality helped make Top Gear a popular broadcast around the world, caused a furor with his comments on Wednesday as nurses, teachers, and civil servants staged a one-day strike. He got into more trouble with a column in the British newspaper mocking people who commit suicide by jumping in front of trains. I don't think we've yet heard an apology from him about that. Jersey Shore star. Boy, those words don't feel good coming out of the mouth together. Vinny Guadagnino has apologized for a song published this week that sparked outrage with its lyrics about rape. "I'd like to apologize for the rap," Guadagnino wrote in a post on his blog after many criticized his ill-conceived new song, Rack City Mix, which he uploaded to his YouTube page just this Wednesday. Was meant to be a funny take on an already dirty song, funny since I'm known as the good boy. I am, and I am, 100% against violence of any kind, he continued. I work with many organizations to stop violence and bullying and will continue to. It's something I strongly believe in. Very sorry to anyone I've offended. Good boy, Vinny. You are a good boy. The outgoing Kyrgyz president, Rosa Otunbayeva, has publicly apologized for her failure to prevent deadly ethnic clashes in the country last year. Addressing parliament on her last day in office, Otunbayeva said, I am really touched by and proud of the heroism and wisdom of the nation of Kyrgyzstan, but want to apologize again for my failure to prevent bloodshed. And quote, more than 400 people were killed, thousands injured in violent clashes between local Uzbeks and Kyrgyz, that's the plural of Kyrgyz, in the southern regions of Osh and Jalalabad in June 2010. Most of the victims were ethnic Uzbeks. WTVT Channel 13 in Tampa apologized viewers last week for airing an inappropriate live shot of a nude Tampa Bay Buccaneers player during a post-game report. A locker room interview with Buccaneers tackle Donald Penn featured in the background an unidentified player getting dressed, giving viewers full frontal nudity. Later during the broadcast, sports anchor Chris Field apologized. A viewer posted a video on YouTube Sunday night, and Tampa area sports radio stations had plenty to talk about. TVT Vice President and News Director John Hoffman said, we issued the following apology during last night's newscast. Earlier in the Bucks postgame, there was an inadvertent shot, and we apologize for that. You know, brief. Nice. Neil Patrick Harris apologized this week for using the word tranny during a segment of Live with Kelly. See, there's no Regis. Just falls apart. Truly sorry for saying the word tranny on Live this week. Twice, tweeted Harris. Should have been more thoughtful. Didn't at all mean to offend. What happened was Kelly Ripa and Harris had inhaled some sulfur hexafluoride, which is helium's evil twin, which makes their voices sound lower. When the gas expired, Harris said, quote, I've never sounded more like a tranny in my life. Well, if he can't say tranny. A Chase Newt Gingrich apologized to Republican voters this week for offering a new doorway to amnesty for Mitt Romney's presidential campaign after Mitt's remarks about immigration policy drew the ire of conservative leaders. He just, in his apology, tried to use the word amnesty in connection with Romney, you see, to make it seem as though. Following a segment about gift-giving in a tough economy, WFLD Chicago anchor Robin Robinson reported something no child wants to hear this time of year, that there is no Santa Claus. Oops, now I said it. Robinson didn't stop with that simple fact. She went on to basically throw a bomb down the chimney. Santa, she said, is a symbol of the generosity of the season. You go sit on his lap and we'll take a picture, she said, suggesting children should be told there's no Santa as soon as they're able to talk. But, she added, he's not coming down the chimney, he's not eating those cookies, he's not bringing you anything. During a succeeding newscast, Robinson apologized for crushing the dreams of children across Chicagoland. It was careless and callous to say what I said, she said, before showing viewers a slew of angry letters the WFLD has received about the anchor's remarks. Don't you tell the truth during the news. Come on now. Speaking of which, CNN host Piers Morgan apologized this week for describing the late comedian Patrice O'Neill as she during a brief in memoriam segment on his show Wednesday night. She died of a stroke today, said Morgan. I want to take a quick look at Patrice on Jimmy Fallon to remind everyone just how funny she was. Unquote. After the clip aired, Morgan apparently realized he was wrong about the gender. When they returned to the broadcast, Morgan called the late comic, quote, a very funny guy. On Thursday, Morgan tweeted this explanation. Okay, this was embarrassing and disrespectful, and I'm sorry, I'd never heard of him before, but that's no excuse. Fail. See how adept he is at tweeting? He knew how to say fail. And a curse word that appeared in Thursday's edition of the Greenville, South Carolina News was apparently inadvertent, and the F word appeared in between two paragraphs in a sports section article from the Associated Press. The word did not reference anything in the article. In a statement on its website, executive editor John Pittman apologized. We are saddened by this and assure everyone we will deal appropriately with it. We apologize to our readers and the reporter whose name appeared over the story. The Apologies of the Week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And speaking of F-words and Facebook, the Irish County Limerick village of Effin has been branded offensive by Facebook, E-F-F-I-N, and blocked users from listing it on the site as their hometown. Facebook has been contacted a number of times by Anne-Marie Kennedy, a resident of Effin. She received no reply, so then she tried to set up a group. Please get my hometown Effin recognized. That was also rejected. It came back with an error message saying, offensive, she said. You will recognize Limerick, but I'm not from Limerick. I'm from Effin. Kennedy now lives in Banogue, but she still wants to rally supporters from Effin to have Facebook let the town be put on the map. And I think she's effing right. And now, ladies and gentlemen, follow the dollar. The Federal Reserve and the big banks fought for more than 2 years to keep details of the largest bailout in U.S. history a secret. Now, according to Bloomberg Markets Magazine, the rest of the world can see what it was missing. The Fed didn't tell anyone which banks were in trouble so deep they required a combined $1.2 trillion on December 5, 2008, their single neediest day. Bankers didn't mention that they took tens of billions of dollars in emergency loans at the same time they were assuring investors their firms were healthy. And no one calculated until now that banks reaped an estimated $13 billion of income by taking advantage of the Fed's below-market rates. Saved by the bailout, bankers lobbied against government regulations, a job made easier by the Fed, which never disclosed the details of the rescue to lawmakers, even as Congress doled out more money and debated new rules aimed at preventing the next collapse. When you see the dollars the banks got, it's hard to make the case these were successful institutions, says Ohio Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown. This is an issue that unites the Tea Party and Occupy Wall Street. There are lawmakers in both parties who would change their votes now. He had introduced an unsuccessful bill to limit bank size, trying to deal with the too-big-to-fail problem by making them less big. The size of the bailout came to light after Bloomberg LP, Limited Partnership, won a court case against the Fed and a group of the biggest U.S. banks to force lending details into the open. The Fed, led by Ben Bernanke, argued that revealing borrower details would create a stigma. Investors would shun firms that used the central bank as lender of last resort, and that needy institutions would be reluctant to borrow in the next crisis. The case went up to the Supreme Court, which declined to hear the bank's appeal in March of this year. The amount of the money the central bank parceled out was surprising even to the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, Gary Stern, who says he wasn't aware of the magnitude. It dwarfed the better-known TARP program at $700 billion, add up guarantees and lending limits, and the Fed committed $7.77 trillion as of March 2009 to rescuing the financial system, more than half the value of everything produced in the United States that year. TARP at least had some strings attached, says Democratic Congressman Brad Miller. With the Fed programs, there was nothing. The Fed, ladies and gentlemen, the real bank of opportunity. Ladies and gentlemen, finally, the new F-bomb, foreclosure, confirming things you've heard on this broadcast all year from Eve Smith, among others. Citing extensive abuses of troubled borrowers across Massachusetts, that state's attorney general has sued the nation's five largest mortgage lenders seeking relief for customers hurt by what she called unfair and deceptive business practices. Bank of America, J.P. Morgan Chase, Citigroup, Wells Fargo, and GMAC Ally Bank, Massachusetts, also sued the electronic mortgage registry known as MERS. The attorney general contended the banks improperly foreclosed on troubled borrowers by relying on fraudulent legal documentation or by failing to modify loans for homeowners after promising to do so. It also contends the bank's use of MERS corrupted the state's public land recording system by not registering legal transfers properly. Ally Bank responded by saying they would no longer do business in Massachusetts. Ladies and gentlemen, that's the good news. That concludes this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe and the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.490 megahertz shortwave on the mighty 104 in Berlin. Around the world via the internet at two locations, live and archived on your computer whenever you want it, harryshearer.com or kcrw.com. Available for your smartphone through Stitcher.com. Available as a free podcast at kcrw.com. And it'd be just like all the other banks refusing to do business in Massachusetts if you'd agree to join with me then. Would you already? Thank you very much. A tip of the show, chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and Hawaii desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. This broadcast is on Twitter. Join the 50,000 followers at The Harry Shearer. The Judith Owen Harry Shearer Christmas sing-along with scads of special local musical guests stops off at the Broad Stage in Santa Monica on December 16th and for two appearances at the Contemporary Arts Center in New Orleans on December 18th. All shows benefit the New Orleans Musicians Clinic. By the way, if you're interested in catching up with the show, even in weeks where your local station may not carry it, for reasons of their own, check out live streams across the country at publicradiofan.com. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. So long from London.